once you experience it, I mean, people seem to really react well to it, I think. So. What's that? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a great way to start a school year every year. So. If we could kind of get everybody's attention for just a second. No, but it's on. So if we can get everybody's attention for just a second. I hate to interrupt the good visitation, but I don't know. We may still have some others who are coming in for the regular service time in just a moment. I just wanted to at least express from my standpoint and hopefully from yours. I mean, how exciting is that to see all those different groups praying on behalf of all of those students? And for us, Judy and I talked about great feature of that is us praying, but at the same time hearing somebody else beside you praying. That wasn't a disturbance. That was just encouraging, and hearing so many different people pray on behalf of those students, and especially those that have those students here. How encouraging is it to walk around and see those names and to see your children's names on there? So I hope that that you feel that the benefit of that was exactly what we intended it to be. Provides a great opportunity. Greg and I were just talking. How great would that be to start every school year with prayers on behalf of our students that way? So maybe this is the first annual Bulverde Special School Prayer Service. But a great opportunity to see God's people praying together. Thank you guys so much for participating in that. Great encouragement to me. Hope it was to you as well.
just about time to rock and roll here. If you've got a Bible, you might be turning to the book of Genesis. I certainly appreciate Greg taking the class week before last, and last week Benjamin took the class. Both of them were given assignments. I understand Greg said he wasn't going to follow my assignment, but that's all right. Somebody ratted him out. Apparently Benjamin did follow his, which I am, you know, shocked. I gave him a set of chapters that I wouldn't have been able to cover, and I think he did a pretty good job there. But tonight, what I really want to talk about is, now that we've covered sort of the flood and some of this deal with Abraham and talk some about it, I want to go into a little bit more depth in terms of a foundation of faith and talk about the whole concept of covenants. And I want to use these two as an example, because as we're looking at this book of Genesis and who it was given to, this sort of ragtag group of ex-slaves gathered around Mount Sinai, listening to Moses as he is giving them the information that they need to be able to tell whether or not they are going to follow this God that has brought them out of Egypt. And that's kind of the context we need to kind of keep in mind as we look at that. Now, obviously, the application is far beyond just to those folks. Those foundations that were being laid to them are the same kind of foundations that we need as we're understanding our relationship to God. And I think part of that storyline as we go through Noah and Abraham is understanding how God develops these relationships with people and what those relationships look like. And so that's what we're going to look at a little bit tonight. Before we start, I'm going to ask Larry, if you would, to lead us in a word of prayer, please. All right. As we think about covenants, we have to kind of start with a little bit of background material, because we don't think about them in the same way that would have been natural to those people in ancient times. So we have to kind of just open up with, what do we mean by covenant? What is a covenant? What's a covenant? An agreement. An agreement. It's actually more than just an agreement. I mean, two people can just sort of agree on something informally or whatever, but it start with a dictionary definition. We say it's usually a formal, solemn, and binding agreement. Okay? So we get some adjectives there to describe the kind of agreement that we're looking at. The second definition starts with, it's a written agreement or promise, usually under seal, between two or more parties, especially for the performance of some action. It's common law action to recover damages for breach of contract. Okay, so we can kind of think of it as a contract. But it's obviously an important concept in the Old Testament. It's used quite a bit. But there's some words that I want you to kind of focus in on a little bit. It's formal. What do we mean by formal? Okay, that's not dressing up in a tuxedo necessarily, right? What do we mean by formal here? Okay. It follows some sort of rules, okay? And we have contract rules today. Taryn worked in I work at Southwest Research Institute, and she worked in our contracts group for a while. And sometimes those things, you look at them, you go, why do they have all those words in there? But everyone is there for a reason, you know, and if you ever installed software on your computer, right, and this thing comes up, and it's we call it the EULA, the end user licensing agreement, right? And you go to get it, you must read this because it's legally binding. And it's 17 pages long, and you're just anxious to use this thing. You know, you don't even look at it, right? You're, okay. That's not what you really should be doing with a formal contract. Formal contract applies to both parties, kind of know what's going on here, right? So it's also binding. What does that mean? On either end, you're going to be held to this thing. There could be consequences. And that's where, you know, you start looking at breach of contract and those kinds of words. So there could be consequences if this contract or this covenant is breached in some way. But also like that with the word there, it's a seal. Now, we have a different idea of that today, but we'll talk about some of their seals and the way they did it back then. But if I have a, let's say that I'm agreeing to sell or buy a car, and the two of us decide that, okay, yeah, you know, I'm going to buy a used car from Hal. The first thing he's going to do is write out that it's as is, you know, right? And how do we both agree and seal that we both agree to that? We're both going to sign it, right? Okay, and so that's what you mean by a seal, something that you can refer back to and say, aha, you know, this is the part of that contract that says we both agreed on this, right? So that's all part of the formal definition. The word covenancy appears over 276 times, depending on whether you want to count New American Standard, ESV, or whatever. That'll vary slightly. But the whole point is, it's important. But it's also interesting, because the Hebrew word that it's derived from has this kind of underlying concept of to cut. Now, why would you think that would be? Yeah, they were cutting up animals, and we'll get to why that's a part of the contract there. That was part of how they sealed their contract. So if we look at the structure of a covenant, these are the kinds of things that would be involved in any covenant that would be made. First of all, it's a definition of the parties. What do I mean by the parties? Who's the covenant between? Okay, who are the covenant parties, right? And this may or may not be between equals. And we'll see some examples of some of those as we go through here in a minute. And the structure of the covenant will reflect the position of both parties in terms of who's responsible for what and that kind of thing. We also have typically in here promises. Okay, these are the things that we promise to do under this covenant. If I'm buying a car from Hal, Hal promises to give me this car, right? This can be conditional or they can be unconditional. Just depends on how you write it, what you put in, right? So that's going to be part of it, the promises, conditional or unconditional. Then there'll be some sort of laws or rules of engagement in this thing, and they may include a punishment for breach of contract. They may include termination conditions. You know, how long does this thing last? What are the terms of it? That kind of thing. So you've got these laws that will govern the covenant. And then there's a seal, which in their Old Testament times would have been some sort of sacrifice that was offered. And it was considered to be a seal of the covenant, the relationship. But then there's also a really interesting piece that almost all of these covenants had, and that was that they had some sort of sign, some sort of thing or entity or piece that was set aside or action that would be for remembering that this contract was valid. Now, in our days, you know, what I would have is I'd have that piece of paper that we both signed, and we'd each have copies of it, right? And that would be sort of the sign of that covenant. But a lot of times, if it was verbal or whatever, there would be other things involved. And we'll look at some of those as we go along. Now, lest you think that I'm just making all of this up, I like this little passage. This was from a letter from the palace of an Akkadian king. And they found all of these letters, the Ari letters, and there's bunches of them, but they were just legal documents that went back and forth between a lot of folks, but they all got collected here in this palace. And the translation's a little rough in a couple of spots, and it has the quotes there, and that we'll go through that in a minute. To my lord say, thus Ibil-il, thy servant, the tablet of Ibil-abad from Alask, whatever the name is, reached me, and I went to Aslaka, to kill an ass between the Hanu and the Itamaris. A puppy and a lettuce they brought. But I obeyed my lord, and I did not give the puppy and lettuce. I caused the foal of an ass to be slaughtered, and thus I established peace between the Hanu and the Itamaris. Okay, what does this really mean? Okay, This guy was going to put together a peace contract, right? It says there he was going to establish peace between these two. Part of the seal of that was going to be some offering that they were going to have to bring. The puppy and the lettuce is the rough thing. They're not really sure what that is. The roots kind of look like that. But there's an obvious implication there. What is it? That wasn't acceptable for this kind of a covenant, right? And so he says, no, I wouldn't let him get away with that. What did I do? I made them sacrifice the foal of a donkey, okay? Something much more valuable than what they had brought to the table. So sacrifice of something valuable to demonstrate that covenant relationship was a part of the ancient civilization. So these people sitting around Mount Sinai, they would have understood that. That was part of their culture. Now, there's a lot of general examples of biblical covenants. I want to look at a couple of those before we start looking at the two big ones that we want to spend most of our time on tonight. People can establish a covenant between each other. Turn over in the book of Genesis to Genesis 31. We're not there yet in our studies, but I want to jump ahead a little bit. You remember Jacob and Laban? Jacob had gone to work for Laban for a number of years, right? What did he get out of it? Two wives, a bunch of animals, big party. And basically he got to a point where he said, you know what? This isn't working out anymore, and my father-in-law just keeps changing my wages and stuff. I got to get out of here. And so he secretly at night gathers all of his flocks and his wives and his children, and they escape. They run off, right? Well, how long does it take for Laban to figure out that they've run off? Not that long. They don't get that big a head start. And Laban is not encumbered by all of these flocks and things, so he catches up pretty quickly. But the Lord tells him, you be careful how you deal with Jacob. Jacob's my chosen. And so he can't really do what he was hoping to do, which was lure him back or pull him back or whatever it was. He's got to deal with this. But over in Genesis 31, they're then going to have to set this thing up. And I've listed verses 43 to 45, but we're going to skip through a couple of things there. When you start looking at this a covenant that they made between them, and that word is used in this section here. So, the beginning in verse 43, it says, Laban replied to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these daughters or to their children whom they have borne? So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. And Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. And so they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. And now Laban called it this other big name. But Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day, and therefore it was named Galeed. And Mizpah, for he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. And then he goes on to list a bunch of things about don't mistreat my daughters and things like that. He said, let's make a covenant. Is this between equals at this point? Pretty much. Two guys, they're going to make an agreement. And what he looked at there, was there a sign of this covenant? They piled up rocks, and I've got a whole sermon that I think I've preached here before on piling up rocks, because there's all kinds of places in the Bible where they decide they're going to remember something, so they pile up a bunch of rocks, right? And then they say, when your children ask you about this pile of rocks, you're supposed to tell them about it. So they piled up a bunch of rocks. They said, this is a witness between us. This is the sign they're going to have. But if you go on down, then they also sacrificed animals, and they had a feast together. And so all of these things, we don't know all of the agreements and all that they had there, but they were saying things like, you won't mistreat my family. And Laban's basically saying, and I won't come after you, right? So they had all of the bits and pieces there of a covenant between them. In Malachi, chapter 2 and verse 14, one of the things that the people there were saying was that they just were amazed that God was not listening to them anymore. And he was saying that, well, you have abused the covenant with your wives. And so he talks about a marriage relationship as being a covenant. Are there promises that are made when you get married? Is there typically some laws and regulations concerning that? How about a sign? What's the typical sign that's given of a marriage relationship? Yeah, we normally give rings. Other cultures, it may be different things, but a lot of us are wearing rings. Why is that? Well, it lets everybody know, right? That's a sign of the covenant. So marriage relationship can be a covenant relationship. There were other covenants that were made between monarchs and the people. David made a covenant at Hebron when he was being brought back and was going to be crowned again after the civil war that occurred there. And the people came out and said that he made a covenant with the people. You think that was a covenant between equals? Not likely. He's the king, right? And so he's going to lay down what all the rules and regulations and things are. But still, it was an agreement between them. And it was a solemn, formal agreement. It's also used figuratively a couple of times. And I like this one because in Isaiah, the people there are saying, well, we've made a covenant with death. And they've made some sort of formal agreement. Usually what that meant was, it was so serious, you know, we may die for it, but, you know, we had to do it anyway. They were using it as an excuse in that particular case, that they've made a covenant with death. Well, that's all follows that same kind of general guidelines. But then you look at these covenants between God and man. So those others were between people. God has always had different covenant relationships with people. And in this case, there are several covenants that are listed that were individual covenants. So, for example, when Aaron, in Numbers, the 18th chapter, was set up to be as the head of the priesthood there, it says that he was made a covenant of salt between God and Aaron and his descendants, that they would be given a portion of the offerings. Now, we don't know all of the details surrounding that, simply, but it's an interesting label there. Covenant of salt. Why would that... What does that mean? Covenant of salt. And actually, there's a couple of different variations on that or things that people think about it. It's used a couple of times in the Bible. There's another one up there. Okay. Salt is cheap in our environment. You know, you go down to the grocery store and you buy a fairly large canister of salt for a few cents. It wasn't necessarily as cheap for them, okay? It was valuable, and it was valuable as a preservative. And if you remember, all of the sacrifices, especially all of the grain sacrifices, had to be offered with their portion of salt, okay? So I think this just is part of that reference there to those sacrifices that were going to be offered, and that covenant of salt was that relationship between God and Aaron and his descendants, so we know there who the parties were, just to them, that those portions would be part of their keep. Because he follows immediately after that and says, because you're not getting any land, right? And so they had to have a separate agreement for how they were going to live because God had given these others the land to live in. Phinehas, in Numbers 25, when he showed, now this is Aaron's grandson, and the evil was coming into the camp, and Phinehas showed great zeal for God by taking a spear and killing two people with it who were blatantly violating what God had rules that God had laid down. And God said that you were so zealous in making sure that this got taken care of that I'm going to make a covenant of peace with you and your children. And what he gave to him was the perpetual priesthood. Now, again, that doesn't fit anybody else outside of that. Those two parties were God and Phinehas in that contract. You see that? So in some of these contracts, and then again with David, there was a point where he made a covenant of salt with David. They had very specific people that God made arrangements with. He made some promises. They had some agreements. And all those kinds of things were in place for those kinds of covenants. But in this story that we're looking at, starting in Genesis 6 and moving up through about Genesis 17, we find two of the great general covenants. Two out of the four are right here in the book of Genesis. So the first one is this Noahic covenant. Now, if you look over in Genesis, the 8th chapter, beginning verse 20, and all the way through chapter 9, verse 17, that's where you get the basics for this covenant. What's the conditions there? Well, we just had a flood. Greg talked about the flood and you know, the whole world being inundated, and God had just gotten tired of the evil of mankind continuously and had taken everybody out, literally, right? Just flooded the world, drowned them all. You know, that had to really hurt God in a lot of ways to see his creation that had been all good as we talked about in the first couple of chapters of Genesis, turn into something that was that bad. And so he used water to wash it clean, start all over. But when Noah came off the ark, he had a little bit of different relationship then that was being established with God, apparently, than what was before. So some new things are down. Who are the parties? Take a look at Genesis 9, 9 and 10. Somebody tell me, who are the parties to this agreement? Okay, there's God. He's the first one. Who else? Okay, we got Noah. We got Noah's descendants. And somebody already said it there. Every living creature. Okay, folks. Got Noah and his descendants. To how far does it say? It's a trick question. It doesn't. Okay. So, who all would that encompass? But we're looking at everybody here, right? Because Noah and his descendants were all that was left at that point. So it's basically with all of mankind for the entire future that's going to be, we got this covenant that God says he's going to set up. Now, what promises were given? Look at 9:15. What was the big promise that was associated with this covenant? I won't flood the world again. I won't destroy it with water. Now, did he say he would never destroy the world? No. He just said, I won't do it with water. And Peter makes a big issue out of that when he says, it's going to be fire, not a flood this time, right? So, we have promises that are associated with it. How about laws? Any laws? Look at chapter 9, verses 4 and 5. What are the laws that were brought into being as part of this covenant that we really hadn't had reference to before? What's the first one? Okay. So he says there that you can eat animals, but not the blood. Now, as is good when you're laying down the law, he explains some things there, right? What does he say about that? Life is in the blood. Now, there's a couple of things for you. What does it say about God's attitude about life? It's precious, okay? And so blood becomes a symbol at this point of life, something that is very precious in the sight of God. And so he says, while you can eat of the animals now, because they're going to be part of the food that you'll have, not with the blood. What's the next thing he says? Okay. Continuing that concept of blood is so precious that if someone sheds someone else's blood, what's the punishment? Their blood is left. So that's capital punishment, folks. Now, if you look at why wasn't Cain killed, why did not he lose his life for killing his brother Abel? Even though it even says there that his blood cried forth from the ground. Well, apparently they hadn't had this particular law as laid out by God to say that was going to be the punishment, right? Now it is. That's now the law in this covenant. It's interesting, if you look in the Talmud, they came up with seven things out of this verse. Now, some of it's a little bit of a stretch, but you can kind of see what they're going there. They said that if you take all of that, you can put it into the categories of prohibitions against idolatry, sexual promiscuity, cruelty to animals, that's where they get the eating blood thing, murder, theft, blasphemy, lying. They extend things quite a bit there. And I'm sure that there were other things that were associated with that covenant that may not be specifically recorded, but God gave us these two that we're going to carry forward. So we had those laws. Now, what was the sacrifice? Chapter 8, verse 20. What kind of sacrifices were offered? What you got? Okay, we had the clean animals. That was one. What else? And clean birds. Okay, forgot the clean on the front. Oh, well. So we had the clean animals and the birds. They became part of the sacrifices there. Now, we'll see echoes of this. The third covenant. If we have Noah and Abraham, what's the third one? Not yet. Moses and then Christ. Yep. So in under the Mosaic law, we're going to see a lot more talk about the sacrifices and things like that and clean animals. But were birds on occasion an acceptable sacrifice under the law of Moses? They certainly were. Okay. So here we see the first sort of hint of that as Noah is offering these sacrifices. How about the sign of the covenant? Everybody ought to get this one right, right? What is it? Rainbow. Okay. So God put his bow in the sky. What was the purpose? Why did he say it was there as the sign? It's a reminder. Every time you see it, what are you supposed to remember? That he's not going to flood the world again. I would also say that right underneath that should be the memory of he did flood the world. Okay, so that's both the positive and the negative there when you start looking at that sign and the reminders that it should have. So we have a covenant with Noah that covers a number of things here, right? Now, what do we see about the termination of that covenant? What's that? It's everlasting. Folks, we're still... Anybody seen a rainbow lately? We saw one just the other day. We were in Alabama. You guys might have seen one here when it rained. We don't see very many rainbows in San Antonio because you kind of have to have some rain around to see that. But, you know, they can be beautiful. And you see it, and every time you still see it, it should remind you of that. We're still under Noah's covenant. Now, when Abraham came along, we're going to see in a minute that he's got a different set of parties, was everybody that was under Abraham's covenant also under Noah's covenant? Yeah. Can you be under more than one covenant at a time? You can be. Okay. How about vice versa? Was everybody under Noah's covenant also under Abraham's covenant? No. Okay. So when we start talking about the people in the world that may not have been part of the storyline that we're going to see in the book of Genesis, does that mean that God didn't have any expectations for them or any rules for them? We already see some of them right here, right? That this was for the whole world, all the way down to us. So that's why when I go to England, I don't eat the blood pudding. It also looks gross, so that would help there. So we see that in the Noah covenant. Well, let's look at the Abrahamic covenant. Benjamin covered, did a good job in giving the background of these chapters and what was going on. But let's look at it again from the same kind of view. Okay? So if we look at Genesis 15 and 17 as the primary text there for looking at this covenant, and I deliberately left out 12. We're going to get to that in a second. But who are the parties? If you look at Genesis 17:7, who are the parties to this covenant? And we'll always assume God, because these are the big ones that God makes. Genesis 17:7. Somebody look that up. Okay. So it's between Abraham and Abraham's descendants. That's who this covenant was between. All right. How many of you know whether or not you were directly, physically descended from Abraham? Anybody know? I'm not even sure gene testing is going to help out in that regard. You know, I got a mixture. I got some English and some Cherokee and some who knows what else, you know, sort of Heinz 57 in my background. I know that. We just don't know anymore, okay? So how much of Abraham's covenant would necessarily reflect on us? Not necessarily, right? What promises were made? I want to go to 15:5 and 17:4 through 6. Those are kind of verses that talk about a promise. 15:18 talks about a promise. 17:18 talks about a promise. So look at those and let's see what's the first promise that was made. It talks about in chapter 15, verse 5, and 17:4 through 6. What are the promises there? Okay. He's going to make a lot of offspring out of Abraham. That was one of the promises there, right? Father of a multitude of nations. What's the next one? 15:18. Okay. The land of Canaan will be given to those offspring. How about 17:8? What's that one? Okay. That was a promise. He said, I will be their God. Now, what does that mean? I will be their God. That's a special relationship, right? I don't know about you, but that's one of those things where you look at it and you go, God was promising to take care of them when he said, I will be your God. Which promise from Genesis 12, 1 through 3 is missing out of this? Genesis 12, 1 through 3. We list those as all the nations of the earth will be blessed is the one that's missing, right? In this covenant giving with Abraham, some of the promises from Genesis 12 are repeated. What are the two that are repeated? The land and the nation, right? I'll make of you a great nation. I'll give you the land. Those are repeated here. But in this specific context of making this covenant with Abraham, that one's left out. Why? That was an unconditional promise, right? And who was that promise actually going to benefit? He said, all nations of the earth, not just with the recipients of this covenant. That was a promise that went beyond the specific covenant relationship with Abraham. Do you see that? The specific covenant relationship with Abraham dealt with him and his descendants. But an outcome of that would be a promise that would be good for everyone beyond that covenant. Okay. What are the laws? Now, this might be a little interesting, and I hope I'm not stretching things too much, but if you look at some things that God expected out of Abraham, look at chapter 17 and verse 1. What did God expect Abraham to do? Walk before me and be blameless. Now, did that mean that he wasn't allowed to sin at all? Is that what blameless means? What does it mean to walk before God blameless? Okay, faithfully. That's a really good way to describe it. Isn't that what Paul said when he said, I have lived before God with a good conscience all my life? Does that mean he'd never done anything wrong? No. What it means is that when they find out what they've done wrong or they've done something that they know is against God, what are they going to do immediately? Repent of that. Try to get back in it. Their attitude and their will and their life is to try to be close to God. That's what God required out of Abraham as part of this covenant. He said, walk before me and be blameless. He laid that down. Take a look over in chapter 18, verse 19. What else was he going to do? Now, we get this as part of what God said, I expect out of him, or what he expected Abraham to accomplish. But what else was he going to do? Absolutely. Teach his children and his household to keep the way of the Lord. That was part of what God laid down with this covenant to Abraham. This is the first time we see some of the principles being laid down that Mark talked about this morning in Deuteronomy 6, which, by the way, is one of my favorite passages too, and everybody here has heard me quote it quite a few times. And it's the whole concept of passing this along. Abraham was to take the precepts of this covenant, pass it on to his household and to those that were of his lineage. And he said he's going to make a multitude of nations out of him. So this thing's going to spread. What were the sacrifices? Take a look at chapter 15 and verse 9. What kind of sacrifices did we have for this one? Okay, we've got all kinds of animals. Now this one's interesting if you read that section on how it was done, right? What did Abraham do? He cut them all in half. Remember that root word of covenant meaning to cut? Okay, he cut them all in half. They laid the halves out, and as night was setting, what did he see? He saw these lights passing back and forth between the pieces, and then the voice of God came to him and said, I'm making a covenant with you. These were the sacrifices of that covenant. What was the sign? 17:11. The sign of the covenant with Abraham. Circumcision. Now sometimes we get this confused and we think of the sign of the covenant of like Moses or something as circumcision, but that was the sign of the covenant with Abraham. I put a rainbow up here, but we're not putting a picture of that up here. This was something that was a reminder, though, right? It was something that would be with them. It was something that was part of their culture as those nations grew. And we see that come up over and over again as we're going to continue on in the stories of Isaac and Jacob, and especially the sons of Jacob as we move on. There's several instances where this comes up. The sign of the covenant being circumcision. So, two great covenants. They've each met all of those criteria. But if we want to say, what are the lessons that we would expect that those people at Mount Sinai to learn from these stories about great covenants, the covenants between God and mankind? Okay. They were the descendants of Abraham, so they would have been learning. Some of them might have still had some knowledge, you know, of Abraham, and especially, you know, they were carrying Joseph, the bones of Joseph, out. And so there would have been enough oral history passed on for them to understood some of this relationship. But I suspect some of the details that they're getting here now may have been a little new to some of them, you know, as they're getting things in the right order. Best analogy I can come up with is, growing up, there were a lot of stories that my parents told about, you know, their childhood and things going on. And my brother and I have done a lot of comparing notes, trying to keep things straight. And we've come to a realization that while we both sat at the same table and both heard the same stories, there's about an 80% overlap, okay, of what we agree on. And then there's about another 20% that we kind of go, well, I thought this, I thought that. You know, so there's some disagreement because it was oral history. And the problem we have now is that my father, who's the source of many of these on his side of the family, is no longer keeping them straight either. And so when he starts on one of them, it just really kind of goes off into oblivion. And there's no way to get them straight now, right? Because they're all dead. They're gone. So how else am I going to get these stories straight? Well, fortunately for these folks, Moses had revelation from God to get it all straight and put it down for them, right? So now there's no question about what were these stories were. And what their lineage was as they're sitting there. So, God made a covenant with their forefathers. Did he keep their part of the covenant? Now, they hadn't gotten to the land yet, but could they look around and say, whoa, are we a nation? You get a couple million people coming out of Egypt, by the time you add them all up, you got a nation. Exactly. We didn't go over that, but in that part of the listing of that covenant, at that vision where he'd sacrifice those animals, he told Abraham, didn't he? He said, look, your descendants are going to go off into a foreign land, and they're going to be there for 400 years, but I'm going to bring them out with a strong hand. And these people were sitting there going, wow, that part's true. Now, what did they not have yet? They didn't have the land, but what had Moses promised them? But that he would take them there, right? So they're learning that God keeps his word. What else? Now remember, they're going to be offered a chance to enter into a new covenant, right? Moses stands up in the book of Exodus and reads the words and the laws and things of the new covenant. We don't have time to cover all of those, and maybe if we go on into Exodus, we'll look at the same list of things and compare that with the Mosaic covenant. God keep his promises about breach of contract too? Are there some rules and regulations that you'd best follow? When you start looking at it, the people of Mount Sinai were going to be offered this new covenant. So, who gets to dictate who the parties are in the covenant? Yeah, it's God. I'm sorry. We don't really get a voice in this, do we? Who sets the promises and the laws? God does. Is this looking like a very much of a contract or a covenant between equals here? No, absolutely not. Not intended to be, folks, right? I think that's part of the lessons learned, is that it's God who lays all of this down. Who establishes the sign? Who sets it up for what you're going to do to remember things? It's God. And so really, when you look at this, they were used to this concept of covenant. But maybe they hadn't thought about it in these terms of making a covenant with the creator of the universe, which is how Genesis starts, right? And so now we're looking at the one who created, the one who by his right hand of power brought them out of Egypt and is sitting there at this mountain, and he's going to lay these things down and he's going to say, you wanted to be part of this or not? That's going to be an interesting question that they're going to have to answer. And they got a little bit more to go in Genesis before we get to the point of them answering that question. But I think that's part of why these things are there. Part of the foundations that they needed for their faith was to understand who God was, how he dealt with people, how he laid down the rules, and how he expected people to remember what he'd said. I hope that makes some sense. And as you look at us, there's a lot of lessons here that I hope that have been kind of bubbling in the back of your mind. Because what was the fourth covenant? It really doesn't have a name other than it's the new covenant, right? But if you go down, does it meet all of those same things? Absolutely. And there it's between the parties. God gave it a little opportunity to say that it can be between God and anyone who wants to step into that, right? What's the sign of the new covenant? I think it's the Lord's Supper. He said, this is the blood of the new covenant, right? And when he was instituting the Lord's Supper. So we have all of those things that come into play with this new covenant that these people were having to learn about in Genesis as they're sitting around the mountain. And quite frankly, folks, it's the same things we need to learn about the covenant relationships that we have with God today. Any questions on that? We're out of time, and that's my last slide. So thank you very much.